Section 7. Rapid Legendary Development. That leaves one common objection. If Jesus was a celestial deity, already euhemerized by the time the Gospels were written, then that supposedly suggests an extraordinarily rapid pace of legendary development, which must surely be very improbable. But this is not a valid objection for three decisive reasons. First, a deity can easily be euhemerized from day one. It does not require any time lag at all, especially if that deity is euhemerized to create an exoteric allegory for both the public and new initiates, whose esoteric meaning is explained only to more advanced members, as we noted in Elements 13 and 14. Although the deities and heroes in the Rank Raglan class were either euhemerized centuries after they were first worshipped as deities, like Osiris, or at the moment of their invention they were placed centuries in the past, like Jason, this was not because either was necessary for the process to work. Rather, it was because euhemerization had not become popular until centuries after those gods had become popular, in the case of pre-existent deities, or because a cultural trend had already been established of placing all heroes in the same imagined age of heroes, around the assumed time of the Trojan War, as if nothing exciting ever happened in any other century of history, or in the case of Romulus, because legend required that he be placed in the already traditional century of Rome's founding, so he would have been placed there no matter when his tale was created. We can therefore draw no conclusions about what was possible simply from what early Greeks and Romans chose to do. Second, we have ample background evidence that such rapid legendary development is possible and indeed common. Therefore, its being improbable is not a conclusion derived from our background knowledge, but a conclusion firmly against it. We saw this already in the case of Haile Selassie in Chapter 2. Even the Roswell myth evolved from tinfoil in the desert to a whole flying saucer with autopsied alien bodies recovered from it, all in just 40 years. And that was in one of the most modern and educated societies in history, with mass media and even extensive debunking in print. And yet, as I noted for Haile Selassie, if we had only the writings of Roswell believers and none mentioning what any early critics said, the exact situation we are in for Jesus, we would be none the wiser. Another good example of vast and rapid legendary development is the weaving of fabulous tales about Saint Genevieve within a mere 10 years of her death, or the Salem witch trials. Also relevant to this conclusion is the fact that in antiquity, fact-checking was not commonly valued and rarely possible. This would greatly increase the rate and scale of legendary development possible compared to modern times. And yet, even in modern times, that rate can be high, as the cases of Roswell and Selassie prove. In fact, it's actually far easier to invent stories about a non-existent person than about one who recently lived, because then there are no witnesses to gainsay or correct you, and no living traditions to compete with, assuming either made any difference at all. And yet, as we've seen, Jesus underwent vast legendary development very rapidly, becoming a Rank Raglan hero, complete with absurd mythical biographical elements, for example, nativity tales, the confrontation with the devil in the wilderness, the supernatural global darkness at his death, all within the space of only a few decades. Either this happening to a historical person is therefore highly probable, and therefore rapid legendary development cannot be regarded as improbable, or it didn't happen to a historical person, and therefore this rapid legendary development argues against Jesus having existed rather than the other way around. Either way, no valid objection remains. Third, the corollary claim that Christians would have had institutions in place to reverently preserve the truth and thus prevent any legendary embellishment or invention is not only contrary to fact, all the evidence we have argues against and none for the existence of any such institutions within early Christianity, and the ubiquitous divergences and contradictions among the Gospels alone prove no such institution was operating. But it's also moot. Such an institution, had it existed, would just as readily preserve a fabrication. The issue is not whether a tradition was preserved reverently, although the many contradictory Gospels prove it was not, but whether the tradition being reverently preserved was based on fact or an allegorical fiction in the first place. This crucial distinction is generally ignored by defenders of oral tradition. Likewise, oral tradition actually still changes over time and quite rapidly in deliberate, history-eclipsing ways, even in the presence of preserving institutions. The fact that divergent gospels were proliferating beyond anyone's control already in Paul's lifetime, as we saw in Element 21, and that reliance on secret traditions and allegorical story building would have prevented nearly any check on the development of new traditions, as we saw in Elements 13 and 14, and that there were tremendous disruptions in Christianity's leadership and literary activity in its earliest period, and the Gospels appear around the very time the original founders would most likely have been dead, as we saw in Element 22, effectively refutes any argument that completely new traditions could not have been developed in the course of the first century. This problem can be illustrated with a mock analogy. Imagine in your golden years, you are accused of murdering a child many decades ago and put on trial for it. The prosecution claims you murdered a little girl in the middle of a public wedding in front of thousands of guests. But as evidence, all they present is a religious tract written by John, which lays out a narrative in which the wedding guests watch you kill her. Who is this John? The prosecution confesses they don't know. When did he write this narrative? Again, unknown. Probably 30 or 40 years after the crime, maybe even 60. Who told John this story? Again, no one knows. He doesn't say. So why should this even be admissible as evidence? Because the narrative is filled with accurate historical details and reads like an eyewitness account. Is it an eyewitness account? Well, no, John is repeating a story told to him. Told to him by an eyewitness? Well, we really have no way of knowing how many people the story passed through before it came to John and he wrote it down. Although he does claim an eyewitness told him some of the details. Who is that witness? He doesn't say. I see. So how can we even believe the story is in any way true if it comes from unknown sources through an unknown number of intermediaries? Well, because there is no way the eyewitnesses to the crime, all those people at the wedding, would have allowed John to lie or make anything up, even after 30 to 60 years, so there is no way the account can be fabricated. If that isn't obviously an absurd argument to you, then you didn't understand what has just been said and you need to go back and listen to that paragraph again until you do. Because seen in this more neutral context, that last argument is monumentally absurd. As any judge or lawyer in this country will tell you, the evidential value of John's account is exactly nil, and the value of the eyewitness check defense of his account's reliability is less than nil. So why would we suddenly do a complete reversal on this point as soon as it's a story about Jesus? There is really no sane answer to that question. In this hypothetical trial, your obvious defense would be that the prosecution can't even prove the allegedly murdered girl even existed, much less that you killed her, even if anyone did. That entails far more than a reasonable doubt. The prosecution's inability to offer any evidence, even for the girl's existence, other than John's book about her murder, would get you acquitted faster than any jury could even sit to deliberate. Historians cannot behave differently. The objection that someone would have said something, however, is actually an appeal to the role of evidence in changing our conclusion for Jesus compared to other rank-raglan heroes, and therefore it cannot affect our prior probability anyway. If that is a problem at all, if it makes any difference at all, then it will do so when we estimate the consequent probabilities of the surviving evidence on either the theory that Jesus existed or that he did not. It does not affect the prior, which is the probability before we take evidence like that into account. And that is what subsequent chapters will do. So this also cannot be an objection to the prior probability arrived at here. Hence, I will revisit it where it belongs in chapter 8.